The lesson I took from my stay in Auschwitz was anybody belonging to the Jewish people is not allowed to behave ever like our perpetrator, the people who did the thing to us. The Jews were the pioneers of interhuman ethics. And the Jewish idea of how to treat a foreigner, how to treat a servant, which is in the Old Testament, was taken up by nobody less than Jesus Christ. And what is happening now in Israel towards the Palestinians is exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. They treat them like vermin. They talk about them in terms, I mean, like, for instance, the chief of staff of the Israeli army recently, the Palestinians are a cancerous growth. I mean, that type of talking is exactly the opposite, and is actually like Nazi talking. That's what was said about me when I was a boy, a Jewish boy in Germany, under the Nazis.
The first was that in 1948 we were brought up to believe in Israel, that this was a war between a David and a Goliath. And because the David succeeded against all odds to win the 1948 war, it produced the myth of the invincible Israeli army, which meant the Israelis felt that they were supermen. And you can see how the same myth about the invincibility, the total superiority of the Israeli army affected the Israeli myth and ethos after 48. And you can see it even in the Hollywood films produced by Americans about how the Israelis are portrayed, and of course how the Arabs are portrayed because of that. So you're not only thinking that the Arabs are maybe primitive, mysterious people, they're also cowards and people who are usually have no chance of winning any kind of a battle. Now, I also remember seeing in one of the many atlases, many of the maps on the history of the conflict, that there was always this famous map of 1948. You had thick arrows coming from the Arab world and very, very thin, hardly discernible arrows coming from the Jewish side to enforce this idea of David and Goliath. Now, looking at the document, it was very clear that there was, at the beginning of the war, a parity in the number of soldiers on both sides. And very early on in the war, the Jews had the upper hand in terms of soldiers, ammunition, logistics, and so on. So that was one myth that we had to deal with. And for us, as Israelis, it was important, because it was not just a question whether we were superhumans or not, because there was a very normal explanation why we won the 48 war, which has nothing to do with David beating Goliath. But there was also, it was connected to the myth that Israel was under on the eve of a second Holocaust, on the eve of extermination. It was not. And I say we because I learned later on that I was not the only one who worked on the issue. Benny Morris and other historians, later to be known as the New Historians, worked more or less at the same time, and we all came to the same conclusions. And I found, that the leaders of the Jews in Palestine knew exactly the balance of power. So they produce an atmosphere of fear, saying that the Jews are under the threat of extermination in order to raise the mobilization, the commitment of the Jewish community in Palestine. But they knew, in actual terms, that such a danger did not exist. And again, if you think about the American public, it was very important to sell to the American public that Israel is constantly under the danger of being annihilated or exterminated, which blurs or obfuscates any American wish to look at the situation in a more balanced position. The second point, even is more important to my mind, is the whole issue of the refugee problem. How did so many Palestinians become refugees? The official Israeli narrative, the official Israeli historiography, told us at schools and later on in the university and from whoever you wanted to hear, that the population of Palestine was called upon by its own leaders and by leaders from other Arab countries to leave and make way for the invading Arab armies, and with a promise to come back after the victory would be secured. This is, for me, the most fascinating and tragic part of the story. I found out that because of the way that the United Nations partition plan evolved, and I don't want to go into too many details, but let me just put it in three very short and clear stages, so I think it would be clear to the viewers. The United Nations offered to divide Palestine into two parts, almost, I would say, equal part, 50% to the Jews, 50% to the Palestinians, at the end of the British Mandate, through the year 1947. The Palestinians looked at that partition as unacceptable because they viewed the Zionist presence in Palestine as much as the Algerians viewed the French presence in Algeria. And as the Algerians would not have agreed to divide Algeria into two with the French settlers, so did the Palestinians not agree to divide Palestine with the Zionist settlers. And because of that, the Jewish leadership said to itself, if the Palestinians do not accept the partition plan, we also do not have to abide by the partition plan. And they decided in around March 1948, they meaning the Jewish leadership, that Israel, the new Jewish state, will consist not only on the 50% promised by the United Nations, but almost an additional 30% of the land. That is to say, 80% of Palestine, according to the Jewish perception, was to be the state of Israel, even before the war of 1948. In fact, if you look at the map today, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are the 20% which Israel had decided at that time not to include in the Jewish state.
Now, why was that? Because it was...
Because they had an agreement. That's a good question. Because I mentioned before the agreement they had with the Jordanian leadership, or the king, King Abdullah. And in return for the Jordanian agreement not to attack the Jewish state, they were promised part of Palestine, which was the West Bank of today. The Gaza Strip is something that the Jewish leadership had not yet decided whether it wants such a large part of Palestine, such a part of Palestine which has had such a large number of Palestinians in it. Nobody knew beforehand that the Egyptians would occupy it. But more or less the perception was that Gaza doesn't have to be part of Israel, it could be part of Egypt. And the West Bank, what became the West Bank, was annexed to the Jordanians as part of the agreement with the Jews prior to the 1948 war. Now, in the remaining 80% of Palestine, there were 660,000 Jews and 900,000 Palestinians. Now, even the most moderate Zionists would not regard such a demographic balance as the implementation of the Zionist ideal. The idea of having a Jewish state in Palestine meant having a state with a Jewish majority, if not Jewish exclusivity. And definitely, if you look at the situation, it was clear that if the Jews would not move anyone out of Palestine or out of the prospective Israel, they would be a minority within the state of Israel. And on the 10th of March 1948, the Jewish military and political command have decided to cleanse Palestine, to expel as many Palestinians as possible out of the 900,000. We don't know even today how many exactly were expelled. We know that it moves between 750,000 to 800,000, which means the vast majority of the Palestinians who were supposed to be part of the Jewish state were expelled by force by Israel. Now, Betty Morris, who was a very thorough researcher, went to Special Archives, which is in London, in Reading actually, not far away from London, where the British have monitored every transaction and every broadcast that was in the air in those days, ever since 1936. And he found no proof to any such message coming in the radio. There was no television. Coming in the air, and I found no evidence for anything in writing. And in fact, we know now for sure there was no such call. There was an Israeli propaganda myth to say that the Arab leaders called upon the population to leave. And they wanted to develop this myth because they wanted to hide the fact that they have decided in March 1948 to expel the indigenous population of Palestine. Now, we're talking here about 900,000 people who lived for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, mostly in villages, in 11 towns. And when the war ends, 500 villages are destroyed, 11 towns are gone, 750,000, maybe 800,000 out of 900,000 become refugees. Their land, they own most of the land in Palestine. Their land is being confiscated by the Jewish state. They have no property rights anymore, no land rights. Their houses were looted, and their careers were stopped. It was a real human tragedy on a large scale, on a large scale. And the main responsibility, according to my historical research, lies with those people who decided to expel them, the Zionist leadership. So that's point number two.
Now, who are these people? Give them names.
Yeah, I'll give them names. First and foremost, we have David Ben-Gurion, who was the chairman of the executive committee of the Jewish Agency and later the first prime minister of Israel, a very powerful man. Most of the crucial decisions have to go through him. If he had been against it, this decision would not have been carried out. But he had people who supported him. Yigal Alon and Moshe Dayan. Very young generals. We're talking about the early 20s. Generals in their early 20s. But very eager to ethnically cleanse Palestine.
Since 1967, over 18,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished, leaving tens of thousands of Palestinian families, just like these, homeless. All this to make room for Jewish-only settlements and bypass roads.
The whole system of the bureaucratic oppression, using the civil administration or using the municipality of Jerusalem to issue demolition orders, thousands of demolition orders against families, using the courts, using planning, using zoning, using the whole legal system in a very cynical way in order to achieve political goals. And the political goal is to limit Palestinians to little tiny islands within Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza, so that Israel controls most of the territory. And the bottom line is to create conditions so difficult that the Palestinians will leave the country.
This is a demolition. You see, the municipality is doing the demolishing. And they simply subcontract to commercial wrecking companies. They come in and they demolish the house. So the family loses its house. The family is fined probably between $10,000 and $20,000, and these are often families, you know, that make $500 a month. And then the family is billed for the demolition. The family will get, it depends, a bill for $1,500 or so. So the injustice here, you don't have to interpret and guess and have an opinion and argue about it. The facts are right in front of your eyes. Here's some guy that simply wants to build a home for his family, who's demolished on his own land. This on the ground, this is what we always saying. This is where the true test is. I don't care about negotiations. I don't care about declarations. I don't care about Bush getting in front of the cameras and saying whatever he says. This is the test. If the entire world, the international community, cannot stop a bulldozer from demolishing this guy's house, then what's the international community? What's human rights? What's international law? What's the roadmap? If the roadmap of Bush in Europe and the UN and Russia together can't stop the demolition of Palestinian homes, then how is it going to bring peace to the Middle East? It's all nonsense. And so, in a sense, we're witnessing here the unfolding of a much larger event than simply the demolition of this one household. The family, for the family, this is their whole world. They've invested money in the house, their whole life savings. So for them, they don't care about the roadmap. They care about their house, which is completely understandable. So there's all kinds of levels of tragedy and testing in this.
The third point, which is no less important, I think, than the other two, which contradicts the official historiography, the official narrative, is the whole story about the peace efforts after the 48 war. The Israeli official historiography is that the Israeli leaders stretched their hand and waited for the Arab side, to, you know, to take the opportunity and conclude peace treaty with Israel after the war of 1948. My own research found that actually it was the Arab side and the Palestinian side after 1948 that was willing to reach a compromise with Israel, according to United Nations guidelines, which were very simple: divide the land into two states, allow the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes, and you have to remember that most of the homes were still there in 1948, and internationalize the city of Jerusalem. And in fact, the American administration at the time, President Truman's administration at the time, supported the Arab and Palestinian position, and even for a very short while exerted heavy pressure on Israel to accept what the Americans deemed at the time as a very sensible solution. And the Israelis refused to conclude a peace treaty under those terms. And then there was an election year in America, a different American administration, different American policy, and the opportunity for peace was missed, mainly because of the Israeli intransigence and extreme policies. So if I sort of lump together the three points of 1948, just to make it, to clarify it once more, I would say that the first myth, or the first point, has to do with the myth of the Israel being on the eve of another Holocaust in 1948, because that would justify everything else Israel would do afterwards, in the war itself and after the war. Israel was not. And in fact, there was a chance for finding a different kind of a solution to the conflict in Palestine. But it was very useful for the Israeli government and later on for the Israeli cultural systems to produce this myth of Israel being on the eve of destruction. The second is that 48 war did produce the Palestinian refugee problem, not because the Palestinian refugees fled voluntarily from Palestine, but because they were ethnically cleansed from Palestine. And the third point was that there was a chance for peace after 1948, and not because the Palestinian and the Arab side were the inflexible and refused to enter such peace negotiations, but on the contrary, because the Israelis were very happy with the results of the war, and they wished, they didn't see any need to go into negotiations which might change their or harm the achievements they had gained during the war. So that was the major revelations about 48. And I have to say and repeat it, it was not only my work. It's the work of that group called the New Historians. We're not that many, but three or four Israeli historians who were working at the time, at the same time, on the same archives, reaching the same conclusions or portraying the same picture about the past.
At any time, the Israelis could do what they are doing now, isolate all the Palestinian towns and villages and have total military control.
Why did we have to park 3 miles away in that case? We had to park and then a Palestinian driver drove us here. Yes. What was that all about? Why did that happen
Well, it's because the Israelis consider Bethlehem today a closed military area. This means that no Palestinian or international people can come in Bethlehem or outside Bethlehem. So it is like a jail, you know.
Well, so we had to go to the border and then be brought in by a taxi driver. I mean, we got in.
Well, the Israelis don't want you to be in. You see, you have Palestinian people who help you in.
Oh, I see.
In spite or despite the will of the Israelis, you know.
So but that was, we sort of snuck in a
yes,
way.
Yes, yes. You have to jump over the fence.
Yeah.
Because all the gates are closed. Yeah.
When traveling through the occupied territory, the Palestinian way, it takes only 5 minutes to realize that it will take you more than 2.5 hours to make a 20-minute trip. Blockades and checkpoints stop Palestinians from going anywhere easily. They must carry their goods over the blockades to get to the other side. They must cross highways that would, if they could use them, certainly make their lives easier. But these highways are reserved for Israeli settlers only. Every day, the simple supplies of a society, food and water, medicine and school supplies, must be hand-carried over these blockades, only to meet with other blockades, ditches, and checkpoints on the other side. This is living the Palestinian way.
What Barak was offering in terms of the land deal was, I would say, 80% of the West Bank and Gaza, but not contiguous. Basically, keeping most of the settlements intact and the Israelis living in the settlements in blocks. And so what we were going to have were three separate blocks of Palestinians with bypass roads in the middle, sort of bordering as moats around these Palestinian areas. And then in key strategic areas, especially on the borders, we'd have the settlement blocks. And the Jewish settlements and the Jewish population in the settlements would be living this privileged life, as I was talking about, under a completely separate body of law with total freedom of movement, that block, while the Bantustan would be subject to permits, would be subject to military order, etc. There would not be any viable independence, and the Israelis would still maintain control of the larger picture.
What this map tries to show is in green, dark green and light green, which are areas A and B, how the Palestinian areas are so carved up into little tiny enclaves, that this is, in a sense, what the Palestinian state would be.
This is certainly not liberation. This is not autonomy. This is not dignity. And, of course, the issue of Jerusalem was not clear. Put this all together, Arafat couldn't have signed this. Clinton wanted to go down in history as making this historical agreement. Barak was losing his popularity. He needed this peace agreement to continue. They both, for political reasons, pushed Arafat. When Arafat said no, Clinton got on Israeli TV and blamed Arafat. And Ehud Barak demonized Arafat. Shlomo Ben Ami blamed it all on Arafat. And a month later, we had the Intifada. And from that on, you know, the attempt to exclude Yasser Arafat, an elected leader, from the whole process. The whole idea of this Bantustan was preserving Israeli control and privilege. And you can't maintain this privilege at the expense of others. It just will never work. It may work for a while, but it's not long-lasting. South Africa, apartheid went on for years, decades. I mean, the turn of the century was the first steps of apartheid. Until 1990, it took almost a century to overthrow apartheid.
I use an analogy that people find very useful to make that switch from territory to control. The example of a prison. If you just look at a blueprint of a prison, it looks like the prisoners own the place. They have 95% of the territory. The prisoners have the living areas, they have the cafeteria, they have the work areas, they have the visiting areas, they have the exercise yard. All the prison authorities have is 5%. They have the walls around, they have the bars, here and there there's a few control points, and that's it. In other words, prison authorities do not need 20 or 30 or 40% of the territory of a prison to control the inmates. They only need very strategic points. And that, I think, is a very useful analogy, because Israel does not need more than 5 to 10% to control, to render a Palestinian state less than viable economically and less than sovereign.
Israel is a Jewish state, first and foremost. The basic law on human dignity and freedom, which is of constitutional status, Article 1 says Israel is a Jewish and democratic state. Anything that violates the Jewish character of the state is illegal. So, for example, if I want to run for a Knesset and my platform is a democratic secular state, a non-religious state, a state for all its citizens, I will be banned. If I want to start a non-profit organization, and again, my platform is a secular state, a non-Jewish state, a state for all its citizens, a state like the United States of America. If I want to have a non-profit that advocates implementing the American Constitution in Israel, my non-profit will not be registered. In Israel, it is basically impossible to make political change in a democratic manner if you're advocating equal rights for everyone on every level. You can't do that through the political system or democratically.
If you had something to say to the American people, what would you want to say? What do you want to impart here?
I think that there is a large number of American citizens who do not know how closely they are associated to what goes on here. And because they are so closely linked, and I will say in a moment how, I think they carry responsibility, both as Americans, but also as human beings, what goes on. Because the mechanism of evil and destruction that Israel is using in order to implement its vision of a Jewish state comes at the expense of the indigenous population of Palestine. It costs a lot of money. You need a lot of weapons in order to implement that kind of reality by which the Palestinians would lose any right or any title to the land of Palestine, to their homeland. It would not have been possible to expel the Palestinians, to occupy what was left in Palestine, to build settlements, to resist peace with the Palestinians, had not the Americans supported Israel with money, weapons, and diplomacy. And it is the American politicians who are being elected that give the diplomatic supports. It's the American taxpayer who gives Israeli financial leverage to carry out its settlement policies in the West Bank and the occupied territories, to carry on a very cruel, probably the cruelest occupation we have nowadays in Palestine. So it's up to the American people to rethink whether in their name and with their money such things should be done. In the case of Palestine, it's a very evil chapter, I think, in the American involvement in global affairs. And Americans should think about it. Should think about it. On a human level, on a more human level, I've toured America, and I've come to places in Midwest and Mid-America. I talked to farmers, and I felt that the moment you face farmers, or people who have small businesses, people who know how difficult it is to go through life, and made something out of life, the moment you explain to them that this basic elementary right is denied to Palestinians, and had been denied to Palestinians ever since 1948, and most of them were farmers, I think you find how people sympathize, how people immediately sympathize with the Palestinian farmer that had been expelled in 1948, with the Palestinian shopkeeper who had been expelled in 1948, with the Palestinian student who has been denied from his university. And it's very clear that American citizens would understand who is the victim and who is the victimizer. And traditionally, they should go with the victim and not with the victimizer.
Any criticism on the policies of Israel is hampered and made impossible by a terrible trick and crime of Israeli propaganda, that any criticism on the politics of Israel comes out, is induced by anti-Semitic feelings. And our main purpose is to show to the world that we are Jews, and we are conscious Jews. We, in a way, we are proud of our Jewish heritage, not of our Jewish presence, but of our Jewish heritage. And we want to show that you must criticize Israel if you at all want anything good for the Jews in the world, because what Israel is doing is destroying the Jewish world and the Jewish heritage.